the Agile Revolution. This is Craig. We're at the West Conference in Perth, Western Australia. And I'm lucky enough to be sitting here with James Stewart. How are you doing, James?
Good, thanks.
And you're, well, lots of different titles, but yes. You're probably best known for pretty prominent role in the UK government with the whole digital transformation there, is that right?
Yes, yeah. So I was part of the team that formed the Government Digital Service about 6 years ago, which was created to drive digital transformation across UK government. We started out with gov.uk website. I was very hands-on with that, and then had a kind of wider role across government, most recently as deputy CTO for UK government.
Excellent.
Left a few months ago.
So what's your background? How did it all sort of get to that point?
Software developer. Kind of grew up with the web, mid 90s, making websites. Taught myself various things I needed to learn to make them better. Realized fairly early on I wasn't much of a visual designer, so focused much more on the software side of things and data. I was also, when I was a student, I got quite involved in student politics, and I spent some time working for some campaigning organizations, particularly on things like third world debt. So I've always kind of had an interest in that kind of social causes and governments and other things. So when the opportunity came to join a team that was just exploring what we could do in government, that was really attractive. And I found that I took to it.
And so the whole thing, you gave an extremely awesome keynote here at the conference, sort of the history of it. For those listening, about 2010, I think the sort of the idea percolated around this. How did it all kick off? Because governments aren't typically known for let's do something innovative.
No. So there'd been people exploring some of these ideas around UK government for quite a long time. We were one of the first governments to have a website, and there were successive initiatives through the late 90s, early 2000s to move government services online, though that was heavily influenced by the general outsourcing approach to IT delivery that was popular then in any large organization. Alongside that, there'd been a group of people, organizations like My Society, which works on civic technologies, and a number of others, talking to governments at the time, to senior officials, to politicians in other areas about some of the opportunities that were coming. That's the increasing role of digital technologies in our lives offered. And that kind of laid the groundwork. Some people got involved in writing party manifestos and so on. But what happened in 2010 was that we got a new government after 13 years of the previous government, and kind of regardless of the politics of it, that new energy and the desire to do something quickly was quite important. And also the new government came in with a big desire to cut costs, so a big austerity push, and the amount of money that we were spending on IT was clearly a target for cutting costs. Those people who'd been working and building relationships over years were able to say, look, one of the ways in which we do that is we need to be much smarter about what do we outsource and what do we do in-house. How do we work with small suppliers? We need to work in more agile ways. So much of the failure that we get is because of very large programs that kind of become irrelevant over time.
And there were some pretty significant failures in the early 2000s, from memory. I can't think of
it. Yeah, so the biggest one was what's called the National Program for IT and the Health Service.
Health Service, that's one, yes.
Which ended up costing somewhere around £12 billion without delivering all that much of value. Thankfully, there are now some fantastic examples in the Health Service. It's a project called Spine 2, which I saw a talk about a couple of weeks ago, and they took a very agile approach, almost a skunkworks team, just quickly demonstrated that this complex system could be bettered with something they built in a few weeks with open source technologies. That then took an agile approach, and they discovered that by the time they'd got to about 67% of the features that they'd originally been told would be needed, nobody was asking for anything new anymore, which really proved this kind of do iterative stuff, deliver it early, deliver value and test it as you're going along, can reveal how wrong your early assumptions can be, with big savings that come as a result.
It's really great. I guess on the startup, this had the potential that it could have gone in a different direction, I assume, because whilst governments all around the world, and I think about the ones locally as we sit here in Australia particularly, we always complain about the cost of all the things. Trying to come forward and say, actually, we want to do things in a completely different way. It could have gone the other way. They just got to outsource the whole lot and
It really could. And I think that within a kind of agile technology communities, we're also quite bad at talking about budget and cost control and other things, because we want to keep things open. We want to iterate. We want to allow for that. I think that to an extent, the fact that other approaches had failed so dramatically helped us quite a lot there. But I think the other thing that we often leave out of the equation is that the cost of the IT project is usually just a fraction of the overall cost of a system. And so a lot of how we approached things was very informed by systems thinking, and particularly looking for where is there failure waste. So where has bad system design led to demand in the expensive places? So one really strong example of that we had was in the welfare system, where there was one particular benefit you had to you could apply for. You could apply online, but since that system had been developed, the documents you had to send in had changed, and they couldn't change the pages on the web which told you what documents to send in, apart from the very first page in the system. So on the first page, it would say, in a few pages' time, you will be asked to send us your passport. Please do not do that. But when you're filling this thing in, you may have low literacy levels to start with. You're under a lot of pressure and stress. You get through, you see something that says you need to send your passport in. You might not remember that first thing. And even if you do, you probably don't trust it. So you send your passport in, and then we have to employ people to send the passports back, and probably people to man phone lines when people phone up and ask why their passport hasn't come back. And taking more control of our technology, just being able to fix really small things like that, saves so much elsewhere in the system. And then not only does that save money, but it saves all the stress that comes with people having to comply with those broken processes. So I think that's the overall story that we need to tell. Because the technology costs, there's all sorts of ways to deal with them, but it's the overall system that's important.
I think the two things that from someone sort of in the agile community on the outside that started a whole movement was, firstly, your articulation of values, and then secondly, your articulation of the quality aspects, which you call those are 16 points.
The digital by default service standard.
Service standard, that's correct. Yeah. And I've seen, I think the Americans call it a playbook, and there's a few other different names for it. But those two, I think, really started. What was the, started with the values, I guess. I mean, was that just a known fact that the values are the key to everything moving forward?
So I think so. It's probably the design principles, which were the things that we published first and that were clearest, and there's 10 of them, start with user needs. I think that there was a sense that successful projects do start from clearly articulated principles that was just there in the group that was doing it. We knew that this was an important thing to do, though we didn't really realize just how much they'd resonate in so many places. But there was also a sense that we needed to lay that out because we were going to get so much pressure from outside. And saying this, start with user needs, such a simple statement, was actually quite countercultural in an environment where the reason that people thought we had come to exist was rationalize the systems, save money, that kind of thing. And we were saying, well, yes, that's what we hope to do, but we do it with that. The systems thinking element, we need to understand what the end users of this system need, and then we can work out how to do it efficiently. And it was very, very important to articulate that. And generally also, if you're going to go talk to very senior people, whether executives in companies or senior civil servants and ministers in governments, they do appreciate having things distilled into quite short amounts of reading to do.
Yeah, statement on a page.
Yeah, so it worked very well for that.
Mm. So what I'm really interested in is that, because you can look at that, I guess, 8 years down the track, and you go, well, of course. Yeah. And it certainly wasn't that easy. Mm. So there must have been some battles and lots of, you know, late nights and drafts and things of that. How do you actually get that to a point that you can walk in and talk to a minister with confidence to say, I know what you're saying, but this is our approach?
So I think we were very lucky in the strength of support that we had from the main minister responsible for what we were doing. It was somebody who understood government inside out, had a very clear sense of what he was trying to achieve. I don't think he fully understood all the things that we were bringing to the table to start with, but he listened and was a strong champion for it. And we did also have a bit of an attitude of, we'll just get on with these things. So where, like, government policy, typically there are multiple levels of right around processes where everybody gets their officials to brief them on it and then signs off. We didn't do any of that.
Mm.
It's like, it's the web and we have blogs and we'll publish some things. So that was part of how we got away with it. So most of the kind of the difficult conversations came later.
Mm.
And we kind of had to kind of successively work through that and build up alliances. So I certainly sat in meetings with a lot of the most senior, say, security officials in lots of departments, where people would be quite disparaging about this idea that we start with user needs, because doesn't that mean throwing security out? And I knew we were onto something when it was people other than me speaking up and going, but security is a user need.
Mm.
We just need to understand it from that perspective. And when I didn't have to be the one saying that, it's like, that's the moment when you know you're winning. And I think it's really important to invest quite a lot of time in finding those allies, those people who are willing to be a bit outspoken on your behalf.
And I guess you mentioned the leader that you had. I think in order for the ESA to be successful, we always talk about top down and bottom up. But you also mentioned in the talk that where you were located in the organisation, I suspect that probably helped a little as well.
Yeah, so we were in the Cabinet Office, which is a department that was set up during World War One to bring more coordination to government. And I think it's one of two places where it could have worked for us to be. It's either there or in the Treasury, because that's where the money is. It was a mixed blessing, to be honest. I think being anywhere else, we would have got caught up in territorial disputes about why is this department leading on this thing that's meant to cut right across government. On the other hand, the Cabinet Office has got a bit of a reputation for always being the people that are going and checking your homework wherever you are. And because we were running a series of spend controls and we were kind of checking people's homework, we had to be careful with that. Somewhere central where you can take a look across the whole system is really important. And that's what we had.
And the other thing you're really talking about is that you then took these principles and then distilled them down into very much, you know, bite-sized, you know, posters and things all around the place. So I think one of your slides was just, you know, three simple words, starting with users.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so a lot of that happened organically. So that series of posters came from some sketches that one of our technical architects, a guy called Paul Downey, drew. And the design team saw his sketches and liked it and turned it into posters. But there was, even without that, one of the things, we always invested quite a lot in presentation. That was something that we had some people who were really good at and played really well in an environment that's used to very dry papers, some stuff that just has a good sense of colour, goes a long way. But we saw teams all over government wanting to print these things out and stick them on the walls, which showed how much it resonated with some people who were already within the system. And so we wanted to really encourage that. So Paul's sketches made for a particularly nice set of posters. It was quite a lot of others. We did a lot with stickers as well. And other things that kind of help people feel involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent. All right, as per usual with our podcast, a little edit point, and we've kicked out of our room and we're now sitting outside in the lovely Perth sunshine.
Yes.
One of the things that's occurred to me often when I will work in any large corporate organisation is it's you can have your own culture, but there's so much reliance on vendors and other people. How did that work out for you? Because we're talking about a lot of moving parts in the UK government.
Yeah, and I don't think there's a single answer to that. So we were in an environment where kind of four or five big vendors really owned the market. And one of the significant moments for us early on was actually when there was a parliamentary report that talked about that situation as being an oligopoly, so the last step on the way to a cartel. And that set up quite a combative relationship with those four or five vendors. But even amongst them, we started to see some difference, because what we're doing, it wasn't unique to us. There are a lot of people who are saying, as large organizations, we need to be in control of our own technology. And so you'd see some of those companies, and I'm not going to name names just now, but some of them who were beginning to adapt to that. Mm. We actually want positive partnerships. Others who were fighting tooth and nail to retain the business that they had. And that's played out over a long time. So it's kind of interesting whenever people bring up conversations at software conferences about legacy technology. They want to talk about how do we do some test-driven legacy migration and get into the tech. And so often our problems were getting anywhere close to the tech because of the commercial constructs. And this weird kind of balance of risk where all the calls are being made by the vendor. Some of that's ongoing. Some of it we got to a better place. And with some of those vendors, you spend the time, and just like you're picking out civil servants who are real advocates for change, you find those people in the vendors as well. But we did a lot of work on bringing a new set of vendors to the table. We were going to bring a lot of skills in-house, but we definitely didn't want to say, and that's it. So we did some procurement reform, brought in some new procurement frameworks and mechanisms to make it easier for small businesses to sell to us. We put a big emphasis on cloud and saying, you know, when we're getting hosting services from somebody, that should be a utility driven by APIs. All of that modern stuff, a different split of responsibilities and more clarity. And also for just bringing people in and skills, we developed some partnerships. There are a couple of companies that were reasonably small when we started that have done very well out of it. But there we actually hit a couple of challenges. One was some of those companies had to bring up some of their own skills to work with us, because the operational requirements, the security requirements, other things that we had, they weren't used to. They really got that. And I think that's actually something that's just been happening across the tech industry, is a new wave of people are getting that kind of stuff. The other was that some of them were so used to working with people who didn't know anything about Agile, that they came in with some quite dogmatic approaches. And because we weren't necessarily using exactly the same approach to Scrum as them, they'd assume that we didn't get Agile. And we'd have to say, actually, it's that flavor of Scrum didn't work for us. We're more Agile than that, which was, you know, a much nicer problem to have than the legacy vendor problem.
And actually, that was my next question there is, lots of people get hung up on their flavor of Agile and you know, that's not Scrum and those type of things, and who cares? But was the approach to actually sort of give people a starting point and show them the way, and then was it possible for people to, you know, to change the way they did it in their own environment?
Yeah, we were never dogmatic about flavors of Agile. I think that so much of which approach to Agile, which methodology is going to work, is contextual, that you just can't be if you want to be successful. So at the sort of standards level, with the service standard, we were looking for, can you make changes quickly? Can you ship software fast? Can you make changes to the other processes quickly? And then have you thought about quality within that? And usually that would lead to people talking about the flavors of Agile that they used. But, you know, the set of techniques around Agile are a means towards agility. And that the agility is the important thing there, the continuous delivery of value to users. So we tried really hard not to be dogmatic about that. Another thing that I think we recognized is that which agile techniques are useful will change as a team matures as well. So if you're going into an environment that's used to a lot of structures, actually coming in with a very structured, usually Scrum approach helps to just start, like, get things going. But an awful lot of the things that we do around estimation, around the way we plan, all of that actually becomes less useful as a team learns to work together. Mm. And we definitely didn't want to restrict teams from maturing.
So that kind of leads me in two places. I mean, one of the big things in the Agile community is this whole scaling debate.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you want to talk scale, then, you know, the UK government's a pretty good...
Yeah.
What, you know, are there those scaling debates, or is it just taking the small and yeah, you know, making it work in the large?
Lots of scaling debates. And I think... There are some places where they've used things like scaled agile framework. There's one I can think of where it seemed to work quite well. But I think that was because the people adopting it really understood it.
Yep.
They didn't just say, we need a scaling framework. They're like, that looks like it fits the problems that we've got. We've also, there are a number of programs which have run into trouble because they've tried to do agile in the teams and something more waterfall at the program governance level. In most of those cases, I think the problem is not that lack of a scaling framework. Pretty much everyone, it's because they tried to start big.
Yeah.
And all of the trust and the understanding that comes from starting small and then a small single team splitting into more teams was missing.
Yeah.
What generally worked for us, and we were far from perfect, there are plenty of areas where I wish I'd had more metrics, where teams went a bit astray and it was hard to detect that quickly. But what really worked is that we'd started with a very small team and that team had seeded all the other teams. And so there was this understanding and trust that existed there from the start. So many programs, like, they think of themselves as programs. They don't think of themselves as outcomes, and then what's the smallest thing we could possibly do?
Yeah. Yeah, and if you think like that, then the whole scaling debate goes away, really.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be big stuff, and particularly if you're, like, moving people between buildings at a large scale and other things. There's complexity there, and you're not going to get rid of it all. But most of the software stuff, certainly, was... It's just that you're assuming that because this is important, it must be big.
So did you tackle the whole financials? Because one of the things that you talked about earlier in our discussion here was saving money and cost reduction was a big driver for this. On the same token, in most bureaucratic organisations, somebody wants you to go and spend an odd amount of time, which is where the waste really builds up in projects, to go and get a number, which we never meet anyway. So how did you start to tackle that problem?
So we did quite a bit of work on a number of fronts with that. So I've mentioned the spending control process, and that was a set of devolved controls that we got. So the UK Treasury, in theory, approves all spend across government. In practice, it only looks at spend over about £50 million. We got that threshold lowered for anything that was IT or digital, and we scrutinized it all. And we made sure that there was some awareness of what technology can do and some amount of benchmarking against other similar projects going on. There was so much noise in that system that I don't think we used it as effectively as you might hope in a sort of... If you were designing the perfect system there, because really that's an intelligence mechanism. There's all sorts of interesting data stuff you could do. But we started. We were able to say, you haven't thought about the user needs that you're trying to meet here. And so often it was like, we're looking at this from a technology point of view, but actually you've not defined your outcomes. And that was almost always where it came back down to if it was a problem. But it also let us join up teams and say, oh, these people have solved this kind of a problem. Go talk to each other. And I think that sort of a control mechanism and an insight mechanism is really, really important for any large-scale transformation. There's then the how do people get approval for spend? Generally, we did some work with the Treasury on what we called the Agile Business Case process. That, I think, is quite a good structure. It's not been adopted to the degree that I'd like, but there, people can start to adopt it. And what we're saying is that we should align our spending more around these phases that we've put in place of discovery, alpha, beta, live, with a recognition that you might repeat those processes, you might do several of them, but saying that you should have a spending envelope for the alpha phase, I think it's up to £750,000, so quite a lot of money, where you can get that before you've got approval for the later stages, and then approval for the later stages comes from showing what you've learned from that stage, whether that's working software, clear understanding of your risks, clear understanding of your outcomes, and then you can get progressive release of funding with that. But actually, I think that that's an area where the whole world needs a lot more research about it.
Yeah.
So all the sort of thinking about beyond budgeting and kind of ongoing budgeting processes is fascinating, but there aren't many places where that's landed yet. So I think we made some good headway on it. The other thing that's always struck me is that for the much smaller things, there's a lack of awareness of who is actually allowed to approve what spend and how do they do it. So there are, while Britain's a member of the European Union, there's a requirement to comply with European Union procurement rules when you're buying stuff in. Those kick in somewhere around £100,000. Under £100,000, who can do what is quite vague. And when you get down under kind of £10,000 or £20,000, there are a lot of people who actually have a lot more permission than they realise. And we were really lucky to have a few people who knew about that and could kind of go, actually, we just want to try that cloud service. We don't need to go and get lots of permission, and we don't need to go out to a full tender. So long as, once we know if it works for us or not, then we do things properly.
So knowing the rules of the game is a good thing to know.
Yeah, and I think that's true in a lot of organisations as well, of people don't understand how much leeway they've got. And one of the things that let me be successful was that at certain times I was just comfortable saying, I think I'm allowed to do that, so I'm just going to put it on this credit card and deal with it. And to be able to make my case afterwards.
Yeah. So the old ask for forgiveness, not for permission.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things that you were sort of talking about at the end of the talk was the whole idea of, I mean, governments are all over the world moving towards open standards and open data, which is a fantastic thing. But I like the way you brought that back then to just the way that we work. That openness has a lot of other benefits. Tell us a little bit about that.
So I think it's that a lot of corporate environments, a lot of government environments, there's a huge amount of fear in a lot of these systems, and so that's one of the things that leads to people trying to work to quite tight specifications, and because people feel like that's the thing that gives them cover. And genuine leadership requires us to really focus on being a lot more explicit about what we're trying to achieve. And I think that requires a mindset that I refer to in those talks as openness, where you need to be quite self-reflective. You need to be able to clearly articulate, I think, a sort of cascading thing of the values that you're building on, whether they're inherited or that you've brought them, the principles that you want to work to, probably similarly the biggest risks that you're concerned about, because those principles and those risks kind of define the parameters that you're going to work within, and then the outcomes that you want to achieve. And then you need to find a way to build trust with the team to deliver within that. And I think that that's actually missing at a lot of levels. And you can kind of see it playing out in a lot of politics globally at the moment, of say for Britain negotiating its exit from the EU, it is quite unclear what the values and principles that will drive any deal making are in that. But at a more mundane level, if empowered teams understand those parameters, you can actually use their creativity. And if they don't, you don't.
And as long as someone remembers that that whilst that is a emotive subject, and you know, we're not going to go down that rabbit hole right now, but I'm sure that's a whole other podcast. Yes. But you can sort of, as long as they remember that and keep that empowerment, because like you said, if you're empowered and you've got the ability to make those decisions, then you can pretty much do anything.
Yeah. And there's also, so I was talking to somebody a couple of days ago here about those moments when you can't be open about things. And that particularly comes into play when you're talking about things in the security area. I think we made quite a lot of headway on what I refer to as you can't do security in secret anymore. Mm. Security
needs... And he had a security square or something.
Yeah, square of despair. Which, security was one of those. Mm. So too much security thinking has happened in a silo, and security needs to be baked into service design and everything up front. But once you get into specific types of threat intelligence, we know that this particular organization is targeting our systems. You might not be able to tell people about that. If you've established a level of trust through being open about everything else, I think that puts you in a better position to go and say to the team, look, I'm not going to be able to tell you for a few weeks why I'm asking you to do this, but just do it. Mm. And you also then need the agility in the system for them to be able to respond.
So we use this. Just talk about trust.
Yes.
What's the third one?
Delivery. Mm-hmm. So that was one of our many mantras, trust users delivery. They were painted on the wall and on stickers and everything else. And Mike Bracken, who was the first chief executive of Government Digital Service, was known for saying the strategy is delivery. That interpreted in lots of different ways. The sense was that, so it's partly, you know, agile principles, deliver value early, because then you're going to understand what you need next, and you're going to build up trust and good conversations on the back of that. It's a shock to the system when you're in an organization that's used to spending 18 months developing a policy, 2 years developing a business case, 3 years delivering off the back of it. That kind of understanding comes through delivery. People learn through delivering together. They build up further trust through delivering together. And that doesn't have to be a big thing, and it doesn't have to be a death march. And I think one of the things that people struggled with a bit was that this idea of the strategy as delivery means you don't do anything else. Of course you do that in a measured, paced way. You take the time to develop people and to develop the other capabilities that you need to deliver. But unless you've got this regular drumbeat of delivering things to real people, what's the point?
That's it. Yeah. So our process is just the vehicle, not the destination.
Absolutely.
So 8 years on, I mean, people often, you know, you probably see this as well, but you go and talk to people and people want their quick fix.
Yeah.
You know, this has already been an 8-year journey and...
Six years.
Yeah. 8 years since thought.
Yeah.
Where are you? Where are they now? Do you think this is this will stick?
Yeah. So there've been a lot of big changes the last couple of years. I've left. A number of people have left, and there've been some changes of political leadership and changes of leadership within Government Digital Service. I think a lot of these things come in waves, and there was a moment that we had during the last Parliament that may be a while coming again. So I think that it's likely that kind of coordinated, centralised focus and pace won't be recaptured in the near future. But the way that it happened affected a lot of people. Mm. And there are a lot of people who've seen new ways of working, who kind of got the bug for doing things differently. There's a level of maturity, I think, in the UK tech supply chain, which can be built on. And also at the same time, this kind of digital transformation thing has caught attention outside, and a rising tide there really ought to lift all boats. So I think that it's going to be probably a bit less public, mm-hmm. a bit less noisy, and probably a bit less flashy. Mm-hmm. Part of me is a little bit regretful about that. I'd like to see that real surge of optimism continue. Mm-hmm. But we always knew that the real changes that we wanted were, you know, 15, 20 years of work. Mm. There's an entire generation of leadership that needs to move up in order to really get it. And perhaps this is also a moment to do one of the things I very briefly touched on in my talk, which is also start thinking more broadly about the impact of this on governments, where we've seen a big tide of enthusiasm about changing how we do public service delivery, and that's absolutely essential. But governments do also do other things, and they play a big role as a regulator and a financer of the wider economy. Governments are struggling to keep up with the pace of innovation in the wider economy. You see the conflicts with Uber and with others going on there. I really hope that the ripple effects of this work on public service transformation will also go into figuring out ways to build much better collaboration around that future of regulation and investment.
Yeah, I think one of the things that stuck with me when I heard Lindsay Homewood, who from the DTA, was it the DTA here, had a great way of saying that the corporates are meant to be fast and government is meant to be slow and stable. Yeah. And those frustrations when particularly I flick between the commercial sector and the public sector, and that frustration of wow, this is so slow, but you actually realise that's by design.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean we can't be smarter about what we do.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to kind of work out for any given part of the system what the appropriate pace for it is. And there are things that ought to be reflective, and there are other things that ought to respond really quickly. So I think of things like when you're reforming the benefits or tax systems, there are elements of that that are really just about carrying out a set of calculations, getting some information about some people so that you can apply those calculations to them, and paying some money out or taking some money in. And those core components, they ought to, from a tech point of view, be able to change really rapidly because that's just good tech practice, but they're just core components, and they'll have one pace, and then you've got a societal political discussion about what is the right level of taxation and what do we want to get from it, what are the right levels of benefits and who should they go to, that probably change at a different pace. And the important thing is that those things can be sequenced effectively, and that that society's wishes, as expressed through its government, aren't constrained by bad technology, but also that the technology is invested in as an ongoing asset.
Mm. I think one of the things that sort of stuck in front of a bus stop.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that stuck with me, that one of your sort of closing slides there, was sometimes the big frustration for anybody trying to roll out agility, whether it be in a two-person company or a 200,000-person organisation, is just how do you get started? And I think one of the things that you sort of mentioned is you've got to lead that by the example. If you can get people inspired and actually that I can make change, that's the real process. Any sort of tips and suggestions there?
Yeah, I think that there is a degree to which it is just to find something and do it and show that it can be done. Where I think that it works best is if you can find somewhere where there is somebody who can really clearly express an outcome that they want to achieve. So I've been in some conversations with some people recently where they've said things like, we want to digitize driving licenses. And I'm like, really? That doesn't sound very interesting. And it doesn't sound very transformative. But if you turn that conversation into people are going to need to be able to prove their age in more settings and we want to do that in a better way, you've then got a more interesting and useful outcome where you've not set out from the start on what the implementation is, but you've got something where you can think about how you get traction there. And then the trick is really quickly turning that into some sort of a prototype, something. And it's not quite as it was when we started, but in a lot of big organizations, it's still the case that the ability to turn something around in a couple of weeks is so unusual. Mm. And I still often think back to the time when a friend and I, early days of the alpha version of gov.uk, in a week, used the Django framework to put together a system that would let us have a database of government departments and ministers and a couple of other things with it. And we thought, well, of course that took a week, because, you know, Django gives you lots of stuff out of the box. But we demoed it at the end of the week, and people's jaws hit the floor. Like, isn't that months of work? Probably to make it really good, it is, but no. Here
well,
it
that's,
is.
Well, that's just got five names in it, surely not. Now, all of them are listed in there, right?
Yeah, the challenge of actually looking at how many departments there are and how many agencies and what the formal relationship, that's the slow process. Yeah. But I think, yeah, that don't start until somebody can really express an outcome and an outcome at the right level. But once they do, just turn something around. Don't worry about purity of code and design or anything like that. Just turn something around.
Yeah, good advice. So one of the really nice things about all the work that that you and your peers have done is that a lot of it is available for people to go and suck up. Is there sort of a place where there's a good place for people to start, they want to know more?
Yeah, so we put quite a lot of effort into what we call the Digital by Default Service Manual, which you can find at gov.uk/service-manual. And that's a kind of starting point for a lot of stuff. There's all sorts of code scattered around GitHub. There's a lot of it there. I'm very proud that we got a lot of it there. It's really hard to find your way around. So service manual is probably a better starting point. The other thing to look for, and I can't remember the URL for this, but if you just search for UK Government Technology Code of Practice. So the service manual was very much rooted in how do we do the digital service delivery. The technology code of practice was the thing that underpinned the spend controls. And it's when they came together that I think that you get the real power.
Excellent. And obviously you've moved on to greener pastures now, and doing lots of interesting things. But if people want to find out more about you.
Yeah, so I'm jystewart.net, Stewart, STEWART. I'm also jystewart on Twitter. Not been very active there recently. I must get back to that. But yeah, I blog occasionally, and all my contact details are there.
Excellent. Well, as someone who occasionally has to suffer through working in different local and federal government departments, I thank you for all your efforts, because it gives you something to go, this is actually achievable. And similarly, when I work in large corporates, so thank you for what you've given back to the community. One last thing we do on the podcast, we like to finish with the Agile Revolution, so we like to say Viva la Revolution. So would you join us in one of those?
Sure.
Viva la Revolution. Thank you. Okay.